This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting app, and Final Rise, premium quality, made in USA hunting vests and field apparel, and Upland Gun Company, custom built and fit handcrafted Italian shotguns. Hey everyone, welcome to episode number 264 of the Birdshot Podcast featuring Dr. Eric Blumberg of the University of Maine and one of the project principal investigators on the Eastern Woodcock Migratory Research Cooperative. We're talking woodcock migration today, and Eric will join us in just a few minutes. I will quickly thank Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast and remind you that everyone signed up as a patron by the end of the month will be eligible for that Onyx Elite subscription card. We'll be giving that away in April. Patrons are also eligible for bonus content, those Patreon giveaways, and the Birdshot Podcast canned coolers and stickers. You can learn more and sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. And another reminder that the American Woodcock Society membership drive is ongoing through the end of the month for listeners of the Birdshot Podcast. If you caught our episode last week, you learned a little bit more about AWS. And in listening to today's show, you will hear how the American Woodcock Society continues to play a role in supporting the Eastern Woodcock Migration Study. Again, you can take advantage of that membership drive, get some cool benefits and bonus items, depending on what level you sign up for. Look for the link in the show notes for the AWS membership drive. Sign up before the end of the month to get that Birdshot Podcast listener promo. All right, we are continuing our sort of unplanned woodcock theme this month, and I may even continue it next week if I can coordinate schedules and get a specific recording done. But it's a great time of year to be talking woodcock migration as they continue to migrate north and show up in our backyards. I saw my first one here in Duluth last Friday and haven't been out much since, so that's the only one I've seen to this point. But with woodcock migration in mind, I thought what better time to get Dr. Eric Blumberg back on the show. We interviewed him back in 2019, and I wanted to catch up with him to see how the migration study has continued and progressed in the years since our previous conversation. And to no surprise, Eric and the team have been hard at work gaining valuable insights into the woodcock migration research, as well as some more incredible anecdotes of what these little birds are capable of during their long journey in both the fall and the spring. So I hope you enjoy this one and learn something new about woodcock migration. And with that said, let's welcome into the conversation and back to the Birdshot Podcast of the University of Maine, Dr. Eric Blumberg. Actually, I looked this up on last week. January 31st, 2019. That was the last time we had you on the show, Eric.
Yep.
So welcome back. It was the Project Upland podcast at that time. It is now the Birdshot podcast, in case you've been following along, but it's still yours truly here, and we've got Dr. Eric Blumberg back on the show to talk woodcock migration. Welcome back, man.
Nick, good to be back.
How's your dad doing, by the way?
Oh, dad's doing great. Still living the dream in central Wisconsin, I guess. He texted me the other day that the woodcock are back, male displaying in the field behind the kennel. So, yeah, doing good.
I figured you would be getting some Midwestern woodcock updates from dad.
Well, and his other new favorite hobby, and he'll be listening to this, so is sending pictures from his cell phone trail cam on the clear cut that they put in on the property last winter.
Ooh.
Everything from wolves and red-shouldered hawks to turkeys and deer. So that's been fun to see the wildlife responding to that clear cut.
Yeah, you got to love those cell phone updates. I don't have any cell cameras. I don't really have anything that I'm keeping that close of tabs on, but I could imagine if I had a piece of property in the clear cut like that, I might have one.
Yeah.
It's obviously been an incredibly weirdly mild winter across much of the country. What you're out in Maine there. What's it been like out that way?
Yeah, super early start to spring, or at least mm-hmm. what feels very much like spring. I actually just the other day looked, and on March 16th of 2023, I was catching crappies on 12 inches of ice. And then 2 days ago, I was out in my canoe paddling on open water. So huge difference between 2 years there. Woodcock came back, probably a half a week or so early in my experience. We usually expect, we just had here at the University of Maine, we just had our spring break, and we usually expect them to show up mid spring break. That's kind of the standard. And, you know, the first one that I found with my dog was on a week ago, Saturday, here in central Maine.
Okay.
So, yeah, early spring. Fiddleheads are starting to come up already.
Oh, wow. You're getting a little bit of green out there?
Yep.
Yeah. What about snowfall historically where you are and then this year?
This was a pretty low snow year. Yep. I do think, you know, since I've lived here, which has been just about a decade, you know, and we're in sort of a central, like pretty much smack dab in central Maine. And we have some good winters where we get good snowpack, and good snowpack, you know, might be 12 to 24 inches, let's just say, kind of midwinter base. And we get some winters where it's just this kind of like alternating cycle of we get some snow and then it warms up and then we get rain and then it ruins the snow and all of that. And Maine is an interesting place. It's very diverse climatically. We have, I forget if it's 4 or 5 different climate zones in the span of just a couple hundred miles as you move inland from the coast. So even just a few hours north of me, winter looks incredibly different than it does where I live here in central Maine. This winter in particular, we got some snow early. There was a little bit of cross-country skiing, not a ton. And then, you know, from my perspective, we kind of came into February and I kept thinking to myself, all right, we're going to get like the second sort of resurgence of winter at some point, and it just never happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, had a bunch of fairly big rain events throughout February and into early March.
Okay.
And that is sort of the kiss of death for any either snow or ice that we had.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's, man, I mean, we could spend a whole episode talking about everybody's kind of experienced it. So it's been weird. We see that, you know, that anything coastal, you know, you're going to have that huge climatic difference. I mean, we see it a little bit here just on the shores of the Great Lake, where it might be one thing right here where I'm at in town, but then inland, you're going to have something totally else going on. But yeah, we have zero snow here, and now it's going to be cooler, relatively cool this week, and we might get some snow later this week, I had heard. But like you, I saw the first, my first physical sighting of a woodcock last Friday. I think I was out running the dogs, and we found some grouse, and actually the woodcock was not pointed by the dogs. I actually foot flushed it. just walked it up, and it flushed, flew a little ways, landed on the trail, and I was like, pretty sure that was a woodcock, and went around the corner, and sure enough, there it was. And then the dog saw it after I had him stopped and watching me flush it down the trail. But yeah, they're back here. So this will be a good question now. So the woodcock, I have known them to be, and you can obviously speak to this a lot better than I can, but they definitely seem to be very opportunistic as far as they will hop around and move north, south, east, west to kind of get away from snowpack or to better conditions. So in this sort of shoulder season where I've got woodcock here, you've got them there, what concerns or if any do you have regarding weather and precipitation and snowfall and cold, that kind of thing?
Yeah. I don't have a ton, to be honest with you. You know, we actually had an undergraduate student here who did her honors thesis, Katie Treblecock, and she looked at that question in particular. So she took all of our satellite tracking data. She found a national database of extreme weather events, and then she looked through and she looked at all the situations where we had woodcock in a place, and she had to summarize it at the county level because that's how the weather data were presented. But where we had a woodcock in a particular place where something that NOAA categorized as an extreme weather event hit during spring migration. No, she looked at wintering and she looked at spring migration.
Yep.
And we found relatively little instances where we just lost track of the bird following that extreme weather, which would indicate to us that it died and its transmitter stopped functioning. And a lot of times they just ride it out. They just sit kind of tight where they're at. About half of the time, they'll make some sort of a movement away from that particular location. So woodcock has been hanging out in point X, and they kind of do two different things there. Well, they have two different options to them anyhow. One is they can sort of backtrack, right? Like fly back south, get out of the cold, if you will. And that's actually sort of like the least common strategy that they use. We'll see them oftentimes where they'll move, you know, sort of a shorter distance. So I'm thinking more like 10 to 20 miles, something like that. Okay. You know, presumably they do that. They're like looking for a more favorable microsite. So, you know, maybe going down like along a stream corridor or something like that, where, you know, the soil's still going to be wet if everything else froze, something along that nature. Surprising amount of time, they just like keep going forward, keep heading north. They'll just kind of go right through it and just keep heading north. One thing we do see, you know, especially with the males, as they get further north, they do bounce around when they hit that snow line. And especially like for us here, it seems like that tends to happen a lot more when they get up into Canada. So in areas of Quebec or New Brunswick or even Nova Scotia, we see a lot more just sort of like bouncing around, you know, where the bounces are, you know, the bird flies 50 miles north and then goes 40 miles south. And then, you know, and I sort of interpret that, and I don't have any way of knowing in particular, but that they are, you know, like moving around, either trying to find patches of open ground or, you know, I suppose if we're talking males, the places where the females have also already shown up. But usually in the States, they're pretty directional. They're pretty directional as they're heading north.
Once they kind of get going, they head that way.
Yep.
Yeah, that's always been something I guess, pondered a little bit, you know, as we obviously make our observations and pay attention to the weather and do our backyard biology, that sort of thing. So that's where, you know, it's really neat. The GPS technology is coming along, and the research that you and your teams are doing to really get some data surrounding the bird movements and stuff. But I know when I went down to one time, I went down to hunt woodcock in Louisiana, and in just conversing with the folks down there, we were hunting covers that, like the week prior, were totally covered up in woodcock, and we flushed like a bird or two. And so they were moving around on their wintering grounds, and that may be, you know, it completely different than why they would be moving around in the situation that we're talking about. What do you see on that end of things? Are they moving around when they're down there on the Gulf in Louisiana? Anything that we could point to say, yes, this is why they're moving?
Yeah, I don't have anything definitive on that. I've had the same conversations with our collaborators in Louisiana. Haven't been there myself, but in particular, it seems like year to year, the places that can be really lucrative to catch birds, whether like they do a lot of banding in Louisiana, and we work with them to put out the GPS tags. And it seems like year to year, there can be a lot of variability in which sites have high concentrations of birds, and whether that's due to, you know, localized flooding or localized drought, or, you know, it's probably a lot of it's tied to moisture. But, you know, I would say over one of the things that's been fairly surprising to me is actually more the extent to which we don't see more widespread long distance movements in wintering or over the summer. So most birds, you know, they migrate, again, whether it's heading north to breed or south to winter, they find the spot they want to hang out at, and, you know, they don't make big. When I say big, you know, we in our research group, we have a magical number, and it's 16 kilometers or 10 miles And that's what we consider to be a movement that would indicate migration. And the reason we do that is because when you look at, you know, we've now collected 600 birds worth of data, and it's, you know, over a million locations. And then there's all these, we call them steps, right? The distance between a location today and a location tomorrow. And when you look at the distribution of those steps, the vast majority of them are less than 10 miles in length. And then there's this second sort of like small peak of steps that's greater than, and those are the migratory flights. So those are the ones that are, you know, hundreds of miles long. So using 10 miles as the magical number, most of the time they don't move more than 10 miles during the summer or the winter. Not always, right? Like there are definitely exceptions, and birds that go on these sort of inexplicable little walkabouts over the middle of the summer. But most birds are homebodies outside of periods of migration. Now, that doesn't mean, though, like in that context of what you can observe locally, that, you know, I mean, 10 miles is a long distance. So you could have birds that are using like one particular cover, whether it's a wildlife area or whatever, and they might make move to somewhere else 4, 5, 6 miles away. And from a hunter's perspective, that would look like, you know, they were sort of here yesterday and now they're gone. But like viewing it from the continental scale, like I do with the tracking data, that's not really a quote unquote long distance movement. It's still a local movement.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great context. And again, one of the beauties of the GPS tracking technology and the accuracy of it. Put a little data behind our long, our continuous speculations and old wives' tales, if you will. So just in case somebody has not listened to every single episode dating back to January 31st, 2019, Eric, maybe we'll rewind and have you briefly reintroduce yourself and just give us the overview of the project, the research that you're working on, and what we're going to talk more about today.
Sure thing. Yeah, so I'm an associate professor at the University of Maine. I'm also the chairperson of the Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Conservation Biology. And my professional background is doing research on upland game birds. I've worked, you know, I did my PhD on greater sage grouse in the West. I've worked with ruffed grouse and spruce grouse and turkeys. But since 2017... have been leading a large collaborative research project on American woodcock. And in a nutshell, what we do with the project is we use GPS tracking technology to follow woodcock primarily on migration. So we use these 4-gram GPS tags in size. I kind of usually equate them to the size of like your average seedless grape, let's just say. They sit on the back of the birds, and they have two key pieces of technology in them. One is a GPS chip that's very much like the GPS in our phones or in our dogs' tracking collars. Gives you that positional accuracy, you know, in the neighborhood of 10 to 20 yards, let's say. So we get pretty detailed information on where the bird is. But then it has a secondary transmitting device on it, which is referred to as a platform terminal transponder, or PTT is the acronym there. And it talks to a different set of satellites that are orbiting the Earth, the Argos satellite network. And what it does is it takes those GPS points it's collected, it relays them to the Argos network. And then from that satellite network, we can download the data points and get them in hand. And the really key aspect of that, and the thing that's kind of frankly revolutionized our way to follow woodcock on migration. When you have a bird that's migrating over hundreds or thousands of miles, if you put a device on it to get the information from that device, you can't follow that same bird over that same distance. So if you think about like a dog's tracking collar, you're obtaining the data from the tracking collar via the radio signal between your handheld GPS and the dog, and that's the data transmission mode.
You've got like a 9-mile range on that or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, the people out there with English pointers know that once they get far enough away, you can't see them anymore.
Exactly.
So we deal with this problem with our woodcock by having this secondary satellite communication network that that allows us to follow them wherever they go. And so what that's done is it's facilitated the ability to just, you know, reconstruct entire migration paths for individual birds. You know, it, when we first started doing this in 2017, it was relatively new. You know, now we're getting to the point where I probably can't refer to it as super novel technology anymore because we're, you know, nearing on a decade of being able to do it. But it did really revolutionize the way that we could study woodcock migration and migration of small birds in general. So, you know, we armed with the capacity to follow the birds, you know, we started working with partners, which included the Ruffed Grouse Society and American Woodcock Society. They've been big supporters of the project since the inception. And then individual state and federal agencies to leverage a cooperative effort to study woodcock migration using these GPS tags. So individual state agencies came forward with funding. RGSAWS provided funding. We've been able to support a series of graduate students along with a colleague of mine, Amber Roth, here at the University of Maine, and cooperators at other universities. We work with researchers at the University of Rhode Island and SUNY Brockport in New York, who are also involved in the project. But the whole idea was bringing together sort of a diverse suite of funding and then also a diverse number of people throughout the eastern range of woodcock that were willing to invest time and effort in catching birds and marking them with GPS tags so that we could both track them, you know, from the northern areas here in the breeding ground south in the winter and then mark birds throughout the wintering grounds and follow them north on their spring migration in the summer. And so, you know, we started in 2017 with six tags that we put out here in Maine, thanks to RGSAWS support. And that's, you know, since turned into a data set of over 600 marked woodcock that have migrated to just about every place that woodcock usually are. We haven't had any of our birds that have sort of drifted too far out into the Great Plains where, you know, woodcock do stop over. I think our westernmost records are, we've had a number of birds end up in Oklahoma. And we had at least one bird end up in southeastern Manitoba. But in terms of the core woodcock range, we've got pretty good coverage.
Yeah. It is, like, would you describe the Mississippi River corridor as kind of like, not the western border, but like, is that the core of the western flight?
Yeah, it's interesting you ask that, because so we put out a bunch of transmitters in Louisiana this winter, and I've been watching those birds, and yes, except you'd be surprised how many of them sort of swing east of the river corridor proper and migrate north through like central Tennessee, central Kentucky into like southern Indiana, and then kind of like hook back and head up into the upper Midwest. I wouldn't go so far as to say they don't follow the Mississippi River, because some do, but like the river itself, at least, you know, in my experience, isn't the northern corridor that you think it would be. And we in our cooperative have not marked a ton of birds in the upper Midwest. They might follow a fundamental, and they probably do follow a different trajectory on their fall migration south. But I'm always surprised a little bit how east they swing, even within that Mississippi flyway context.
Right. Yep. So I know you mentioned the 600 birds. I read that in the article. What does it look like in real time? Like how many trackers do you have on birds right now?
Right now we've got somewhere in the mid 30s active birds. The tags are battery powered. The ones we use anyhow are battery powered, so they have a finite lifespan. So we generally program them such that we should get one full migration out of the tag, and then we play around a little bit. The lifespan of the tag is determined basically by how frequently you have it collect points, and we play around a little bit with that so that we can try to get the tag to last for a full year, in particular because we're interested in, you know, if a woodcock overwinters in one site this year, is it going to overwinter in the same site next year?
Right.
Which is site fidelity and the same thing on the breeding grounds. Some satellite tracking technology uses solar panels on other critters. And that obviously, you know, has the capacity to recharge batteries and increase battery life. And we haven't yet found a good tag for a woodcock size bird that gives us the same sort of information that we get from the ones we use that are battery powered. So we haven't gone the realm of, and then we also have some concerns over, you know, how effective solar charging will be under, say, like the forest canopy in the right. summer. But it's on the to-do list is to try and pilot some solar powered tags. But coming back to your question though, we've got something like mid 30s of the birds, and without going too deep into the details, we do play around with the way in which we program the tags to take points depending on the particular research questions we're after. So right now, those birds that are migrating north, marked in Louisiana this winter, the primary research goals with them were we wanted to look at the timing of migration going north and into the sort of Midwestern portion of the range in particular. And that has to do with the timing of the population monitoring methods that they use, the singing ground survey to assess woodcock populations. We've got a gap in our current data right now that we haven't had a lot of birds go into, say, like Wisconsin, Minnesota, portions of Western Ontario. And so we want to know how the migration timing in those regions aligns with the timing of those surveys. So that's one question. We've also been doing a bunch of work trying to look at the genetic signatures of woodcock throughout their range. And again, we sort of have a current data gap right there. So we're hoping those birds, they all had their blood taken when they were caught. So we have their genetic sample, and now we can look at their eventual breeding location. And then more questions around those fidelity questions. So do they return back to the same place in Louisiana next year? So all of that comes together where at the present, the tags that we're following, they collect a location every 3 days. So it's not as precise as we always like. Like in a perfect world, we know where the bird is every single day.
Sure.
A lot of the time when they're migrating, actually most of the time, if they stop somewhere, it's only for one night or for one day, and then they continue migrating. So if you don't get daily locations, you miss some of that. Some of them stopovers, but you still know, generally speaking, the timing of migration because
you've got the end point and the start point, basically. Yeah.
You might miss some gaps in between, some date, some spots in between, but we're not as concerned about that right now. But spreading the points out like that is going to lengthen the lifespan of the tag. It's going to ensure that we follow the bird all the way to their eventual settling point in the breeding areas, so we can define that really clearly. And it's going to also like increase the chance that we might be able to get some locations from them on their fall migration coming back next year. So we get a GPS point from the bird every 3 days, and then the tags are such that every third location we get is when it talks to that second satellite network and transmits the data. So I'm only really operating on like a plus or minus 9 day resolution in terms of how frequently any given bird we're watching we get data from. But we're usually getting updates on some of the birds every few days.
Yeah, you've got them staggered. So you real time or constant flow.
And, you know, to be totally honest with you, the real time data is just kind of like a luxury of being able to watch them and say, gee whiz, look at what they're doing. We usually get all of the information, and that's when we actually do the formal analysis on it. We won't crunch any numbers on any of this until this summer sometime, after we're pretty confident all of the spring migration is in.
The real-time stuff is for the myself and the rest of the backyard biologists out there.
Yeah. I'm one of those.
I love it. Yeah. So what is the, I imagine there, you know, there's limitation, you know, there's cost is one thing. In a perfect world, how many would you have?
1,000, or is there some number that's like, yeah, we kind of know what's going on with about this many trackers?
That's good. That's a good question. It ends up being situational, and depending on the question, you know, there's a general rule in ecological statistics where a sample size of 30 is kind of like a minimum to feel as though you've got a representative sample. But even that is just, you know, a nice round number that somebody came up with once that everybody seemed to agree with. The 30 birds we're tracking this spring are being combined with every other bird that we've monitored in the past that, you know, especially like for some of the questions around, you know, what the timing of migration into the upper Midwest looks like. I mean, we've had birds that have gone to Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota in the past, so we have some sample there. So it'd be more than that 30. Funding limitations always kind of end up setting the minimum, the tags. I know you and I have talked about this before, but for everybody else, they're currently running at about $1,800 a piece. So they're not inexpensive. And, you know, I don't know, it's honestly one of the hardest questions, and it's one of the both hardest and most important questions you get asked as a biologist, especially one who works with live animals. You know, how many are enough? Because, you know, setting aside the financial cost of things, which is always there, you know, you just also have this underlying sort of ethical, we shouldn't just be slapping electronics on animals without a good reason,
yep. You
know, and a purpose for what we're doing with it. And so our team is sort of always wrestling with that question of, you know, what's the next question we're after? Do we need more data to answer that question? I mean, we're sitting on one of the largest data sets, you know, of satellite marked birds that exists.
Yep.
If we have a question, can we answer it with information we already have?
What you've got.
Putting out tags and be able to see the real time data every year. But we kind of always have to challenge ourselves to make sure that we have a purpose for continuing to collect more data.
Yeah.
Some of the things I think, you know, we started this off by talking about what a weird spring it's been. You can't understand how those anomalous conditions affect wildlife if you don't monitor long enough to, you know, catch the anomalies. And then if we think about things like climate change, anomalies are expected to become more common. So understanding the historic context is going to help predict the future. So I don't know, I feel like I've really like talked myself around actually directly answering your question about what is enough.
Well, I think you added a lot of great context there where, I mean, it makes a ton of sense. Obviously, you know, we're going out and we're interfering temporarily with wildlife and putting these trackers on them. So being mindful of that makes a ton of sense. And you guys are the research professionals and obviously you love wildlife and nature. So it makes sense. But then you can, again, just like we're talking about with the weather, you're kind of making the case for like some level of continued monitoring in this and utilizing this technology. And as you pointed out, you're building your sample size. You know, we have historical data that we're adding to year after year. And this is a good year as an example of what are we seeing with these weird conditions.
Yeah. One of the things I'd like to do in a direction I could see us going in the future is, you know, it's probably not sustainable, as cool as it is, to have these GPS tags on a whole bunch of birds and be able to watch them in real time. Between like the cost and the effort involved, it's probably, if I'm being realistic, not sustainable to continue that just like indefinitely. What I think we can do is I think we can collect a lot of really high quality data, and then look to things like, say, the eBird data set, which, you know, woodcock are very well represented in eBird.
User submitted stuff or like?
Yeah. Sorry for anybody who doesn't know, eBird is a citizen science bird monitoring program, basically where amateur bird watchers can report the species that they're seeing. And it's a massively widely used app, you know, tens, if not hundreds of millions of users in the U.S. and worldwide. And So there's all sorts of woodcock data. And so some things like when did the woodcock show up in point X, like you can get from eBird because you can watch you know, all of the records that have been submitted and when they
somewhere saw one and is going to update that.
The thing we're in a position to know with our GPS tracking data is not just it got there, but where it came from. Is it a male? Is it a female? Is it a young bird? Is it an old bird? Where does it go past that? What kind of habitat did it use along the way that allowed it to get to that point in that time? So we have a lot more rich information about the individual, but it comes at a much greater cost of having to purchase this expensive tag and put it on the bird and all of that. So I think there's probably, you know, if I thought about like what the future could look like, it would be leveraging the strengths of the data we collect from the GPS tagging, but then also looking to, you know, broader scale data sets that are probably a little bit more practical to collect large scale and long term.
What are the GPS tags? Are they, do they stay on for a certain amount of time and then fall off? Or what is the end point of the tracker?
They're not explicitly designed to fall off. Some of them do. We tried to orchestrate a harness design, and it's not like there's nothing overly complicated about the harness. It's made with this it's Stretch Magic, which is like a craft store jewelry making material. And then it's got some surgical tubing around it, and it sits, you know, on the rump of the bird. It's more of a saddle than a backpack. It goes around their legs. Some people try to create harnesses for tags with a half-life, and some that are expected to fall off. And some of that would be certain tags are what are known as archival tags. They just store the information on the tag, and then you have to recover it to download the points. And so in some situations, researchers want the tag to fall off before the bird does something like migrate so that they can get the data. We didn't want that. So we've recovered now, you know, probably in the neighborhood of 30 tags from birds, mostly hunter shot birds. And I can only remember offhand, I think, one woodcock that was recovered that we had put a transmitter on that no longer had its transmitter. So we think our retention rates are pretty high. And when we put a tag on a bird, we do so with...
Did it have the harness, but not the... How did you know it was one of your woodcock?
Well, they all get a federal aluminum band also.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
So they have two marks. Yeah, they have the band. And those get reported through the USGS bird banding lab.
Okay.
And we get the information about it through my colleague Amber's federal banding permit. But yeah, so we've had one bird that we've marked, put a GPS tag on. That bird in particular, we collected a full tag's lifespan worth of data for. So it carried the tag, I think, you know, we thought for at least 6 months. And then it was shot by a hunter the following fall or a subsequent fall. But we've had a few that have carried their tags for multiple years and then been recovered. So no, we purposefully do not design our tags to fall off because we want to maximize data collection and the information we get. Yeah. And, you know, kind of coming back to the animal ethics consideration, you then do so knowing that you're putting this thing on the bird that you expect it's going to carry for the rest of its life. But the benefits gained are the fact that for some of those questions that require following them for a long time, like what is their annual site fidelity, you know, requires us to do that.
Yep, got it. On the genetics thing that you kind of briefly mentioned, what might be some basic questions that you'd be looking to answer or glean information on with respect to genetics?
Yeah, so it's both a relatively simple question, but a really big one. So woodcock are managed as two populations by both the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Canadian Wildlife Service. And they split sort of the eastern population are all states and provinces roughly east of the Appalachians, and the central region is the Mississippi Flyway, so everything west of the Appalachians. And, you know, the practical implications of that are, you know, the service monitors those two populations separately. They estimate different population trends for them. And the harvest regulation packages are different. And so it's been a while, but it was probably about a decade ago or so. The most tangible example I can give is that in the eastern region, we only had a 30-day hunting season. And in the central region, they had a 45-day season. And the reason for the difference is that the service tracks trends in the population from the spring singing ground surveys. And depending on the average number of birds observed on those, they'll make the regulations more liberal or more conservative, but they do it on a population basis. There has been a long-standing question of whether woodcock actually function as two separate populations where they should be managed differently. With the tracking data, not just our data, but previous researchers, going back to, you know, analyses of band recovery data, you know, we know that a proportion of woodcock, for example, that breed here in the Northeast, like in Maine, they overwinter in Louisiana. And that crosses those management region boundaries. So we know that it's not a nice, clean, we have two totally discrete populations. There's some overlap. The interesting thing is what we don't tend to see a lot of is birds that are overwintering, like in the southeastern states, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, that migrate up to the upper Midwest and the Great Lakes. But some do. It's a pretty small percentage. It's like 4 to 5% of the birds wintering in the southeast cross the boundaries. So with the genetics work, what we're hoping to do is, you know, we've collected either a blood sample or a feather sample from most of the woodcock that we've tagged. We can use the data from the GPS tags to know with some certainty where that bird migrated north and spent its summer. So we have a breeding site association. And then we can look at the underlying genetic signatures within the population and ask, are there clear differences in the structure of the population? Do birds that are associated with breeding in the central region look genetically different? Do they have a different gene structure than the birds that are in the eastern region? And the preliminary analyses that we're finding is that there's no evidence that there is any genetic difference between the two. So you harvest a woodcock in Maine and harvest a woodcock in Wisconsin, and on the genetic level, they're not really dissimilar from each other, which is actually a really uncommon thing in wild animals. There's almost always some kind of what we would say is a spatial genetic structure. If no other reason than the further away you get from two points, like the animals should be genetically dissimilar. And we don't see that, or we're not seeing that yet in woodcock of the work we've done so far.
So even if we take the rough grouse, for example, obviously not a migrating bird.
Right.
So you would see a difference in a Maine rough grouse and a Minnesota rough grouse genetically?
Yes. And I should be careful before I start speaking definitively about that. But
sure.
There have been some papers that have come out looking at that specifically. And, you know, yes, they can define with genetic signatures different regional subpopulations of rough grouse that are genetically distinct.
And so
in the way that we can't with woodcock.
Yeah. And with a wood, logically, my head would go to, you know, you've hit, like, we've got a migrating bird and we can see that some birds sort of go from northeast to the southern Midwest and they're moving around. So that might negate some of that genetic disparity between geographic locations. Just even just with a migrating animal, maybe you'd have less likelihood, but I don't know if that could be totally wrong.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about woodcock is we've known for a long time that the males, like, they start actively displaying and courting females on the wintering grounds, and then they continue doing it as they migrate north. So males, you know, a male might, say, leave Georgia. He was painting in a field in Georgia before he even started migrating. He might stop in, say, I don't know, Virginia in New York and also establish a temporary territory for the, you know, week or 10 days or whatever that he's there and try to attract females and mate with females. And then he continues going north and repeats the process. So that act of attempting to reproduce in conjunction with migration is, I think, what probably facilitates much more widespread gene flow than you would expect. Sure. If it was just, you know, if they were more like, I'm going to use ducks as an example, but they're a bad example. You know, mallards form their pair bonds in October on the wintering grounds, and then the drake follows the hen to wherever she is going, and breeding site fidelity is largely driven by the hen.
Yeah.
And so there you could have a lot of crossing that happens, you know, where two ducks from different flyways are in the same place in the winter, but because like the breeding association is so tightly associated with where that hen is heading, you might find, you know, you would expect stronger structure in that situation.
Yeah.
But that's in ducks where they're socially monogamous and they form pair bonds, and in woodcock, right, they are not. And, you know, the males are attempting to have as much mating success as they can everywhere from their wintering ground where some hens are nesting all the way to their northern breeding grounds.
So do we know that, I think you're basically saying this, but I just want to confirm it for myself, that a woodcock, as it's migrating north, might mate with multiple females along the way.
Yep. Okay. That's the implication. And the other thing that we've learned, which is really kind of exciting, is the female woodcock are actually doing exactly the same thing. So there's a PhD student right now. I mentioned our collaborators at the University of Rhode Island. Colby Slezak is working on a PhD. And what he was able to do is he took our tracking data of females during spring migration, and he watched the hens as they were heading north. But he, you know, as the data were rolling in, he was looking for any suggestive evidence that the hen might be on a nest because the points were in the same place for multiple days in a row. And then he would reach out to our collaborator network. And if we had a biologist anywhere, you know, within 100 miles of that hen, see if they could go and track them down on the ground and confirm that she was nesting. And through that, what he was able to confirm is that hens will actually attempt to nest in southern locations. And if their nest fails, they might migrate north, and their nesting attempt could be hundreds of miles away. Mm-hmm. And the first evidence we got of this was a female that was found on a nest in North Carolina. The nest failed. It migrated north, and Colby found it on another nest. I believe it was in Connecticut.
Wow.
But, you know, several hundred miles in between.
That was a tagged bird.
That was a tagged bird, yeah. So we know it's the same hen.
Yeah.
And then what he was able to do, armed with that information, is go back through the larger data set and look to see how consistently we thought that was happening with all the other tagged birds based on the patterns that he saw in the points. And it seems that most hens are actually employing that strategy, where they'll attempt multiple nests along their migration. Their nest success isn't terribly high, but they end up trying three or four or five times between the wintering grounds and where they end up in the north.
Yeah.
So you actually have this mating strategy where both the males and the females are breeding at, or at least attempting to breed at multiple stages along migration.
Yeah. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk some more migration stuff. And this, maybe these are things we've known for a long time, or maybe these are things that have now kind of shown themselves through your research, but what factors tend to trigger woodcock migration? And if you need to split that between fall migration versus spring, please do. But what are those, you know, is it the full moon? Is it a north wind or a south wind? What is it?
It's a good question. And as luck would have it, one of the first grad students that worked on the project, Alex Fish, that was a component of his dissertation. And it does depend on fall versus spring. And it also depends on the age of the bird or the sex of the bird, and whether it's age or sex depends on fall and spring. So it's a real like multifaceted thing. The wind is definitely important. They leave on a tailwind, which makes intuitive sense. They like to leave on a tailwind. Just because it's going to make their flight more efficient. But the adult birds in the fall are a lot more finely tuned to that tailwind. So we see like stronger preference for adult birds to depart on a tailwind than for the hatchier birds, the birds that were hatched like this summer. And because of that, you tend to see the young birds leaving later than the adults on average, because they're less able to recognize, or at least we think they're less able to recognize the presence of that assistive tailwind.
Yeah.
They tend to respond much more to temperature. The young birds do. Both birds, there's an association between temperature and wind for both the young and adults, but the adults more tuned to wind, the young birds more tuned to temperature.
Interesting.
Presumably it's the experience of migration, previous migrations, that lets adults recognize, hey, tonight's a good night to go because I feel the wind at my back. They also, in doing that, we also know that changing barometric pressure is one of the triggers that they use to recognize probably when those flight conditions are good. In the fall, Alex looked at the moon and he couldn't find any evidence that moon mattered one way or the other. There's been some studies in the past that have suggested a moon effect, but we just didn't see it when we looked at, you know, and with a data set that spanned from Nova Scotia to West Virginia.
It sure sounds good when you put pen to paper and write about it, but
in the spring, he did find a little bit of evidence that males moved under a full moon, but we had a relatively small sample size for that at the time that he looked at it. And that's like the one thing with moon phase, we think in the past is, you know, if you're working in one particular spot and most of the birds take off at a particular time, say because the wind conditions were good and it happened to coincide with a full moon, then it could look like, oh, they left on the full moon. And that's kind of where the anecdotal evidence sort of comes from. So the interesting thing in the spring, males leave about a week before the females from the wintering grounds. And the wind assistance trigger is not nearly as strong for males in the spring. They actually tend to select more for relatively calm winds. Females still will wait for a tailwind in the spring. And, you know, we think that that probably has to do with the male's motivation to go is the desire to get north and establish a territory quicker. So they're effectively less choosy about when they leave. But the one thing they can't do is just fly into a headwind the whole time.
Yeah.
So calm conditions, more conducive to departure for males in the spring. Females tend to be pickier and wait till they're
taking their time waiting for that prime condition. Yeah.
Yep.
Interesting. On the wind, this may be a dumb question, but I keep thinking of, like, how do they pick up on the tailwind? Is this something like where, and this may be a hypothesis on from your part, but is it like at dusk every night, they're kind of going up to do a little flyabout, and then when they're up there, they're recognizing there's a tail? Like, how do you think that, how they get aware of it, and then the decision is made?
Yeah, I don't know. There's nothing in our data that we could use to answer that, because what we know, they were here on a Tuesday and they were gone on a Wednesday, and then we can look at what it was like Tuesday night, right? But the actual like cognitive decision process that the bird used, we're just like inferring that it clearly decided to go, but I can't tell you why, right? You know, with the exception of, we do know that like all of this is tied into barometric pressure, and I can guarantee you that the birds are sensitive to those changing pressure systems.
Sure.
And that has to like be part of the mechanism. And you know, the other thing too is like migration in birds in general is tightly linked to changing photo period. And so when we think about it, we think about like both the sort of long-term external cue, or internal cues rather, long-term internal cues the bird is using, which is basically like the thing that gets the bird into this state of migratory restlessness where they want to migrate. And then they have these external proximate cues that they wait for, which are the things that let them predict, are the flight conditions going to be good tonight? Because if they just leave when the days get shorter, but don't consider what they're actually going to encounter while they're flying, that's when they can get themselves into trouble by like, you know, trying to cross the Gulf of Maine in a headwind and drowning in the process. So it's a combination of changing photo period, but then waiting for just the right conditions so that their flight is more efficient.
Have you, yeah.
I don't know if they stick their feathers up in the air and
they lick it in the bill and test the wind from the ground. Yeah, it's obviously part of the fascination. Have you that makes me think of us? Have you had any confirmed examples of a bird like trying to leave Cape May and not making it across a big body of water? Anything weird like that?
Yeah, we had one bird. Cape May, like Delaware Bay, is actually relatively short in terms of overwater
crossing.
I mean, they do it. We've known for a long time they stack up at Cape May, and it's mostly young birds that stack up at Cape May. And the hypothesis there is they don't want to go across Delaware Bay, so they're waiting. And that probably is true. But we had one bird that, and I'm going to have to like pull up a map quick so that I get the names of the places right. But we had one bird that was migrating up through Canada. This is in the spring, so spring migration. Went out, it was on Prince Edward Island, and there's an island out in the middle of, I guess, like the Bay of St. Lawrence, sort of between PEI and Newfoundland, and it's all French, and I'm going to butcher the pronunciation here, but it's Capamule Island. Anyhow, this bird flew out to that island, which is a distance of, you know, I don't know, 100 plus miles, and then turned around and went back to PEI, to Prince Edward Island. So that bird either got blown out and made a poor decision and then decided to turn back, or I guess decided it didn't like the idea of going to Newfoundland and turned back. That's the one that sticks out in my head as the example of a bird that sort of changed its mind. We have had one bird that did not change its mind. It did cross. That one went from Cape Breton Island to Newfoundland. And it was like, I think, 260-ish miles of open water that it crossed. So they can do it.
Yeah, let's talk about a few more. Those are the fun ones, the anomalies. You know, the crazy long flights. I think there was a bird that did like 1200 miles in 4 days or something. And then the altitude stuff, you had some stuff in that was really neat. How high they fly. What are some of those ones that stand out?
Yeah. So, I mean, the one you mentioned, the long distance one, that bird went, I think it was 650 miles in one night.
Wow.
Which, you know, we have to assume was with a crazy tailwind. I think it was, you know, the conservative math on that is that the flight speed was like 50-something miles an hour.
Jeez.
We've now, so we do have these tags. The tags now will give us altitude readings. And because we can get that, we've been trying to get creative about programming them so we can learn a little bit more about not just how high they fly, but how fast they fly. And it's more than just the gee whiz aspect of it. Like there are practical implications for understanding flight altitude, especially if you think about things like collision risk with buildings or with wind turbines, you know. We want to know. Anyhow, we've now been able to collect a few instances where we've gotten multiple known flight locations as a bird was migrating. So I can look at the distance between two points and the time between them. And they're usually flying at about 20, 25 miles an hour. With the data we have, like that's probably more normal. So that particular bird was rocking along about twice as fast as what we've seen in some other instances. So he had a pretty good tailwind. And yeah, the altitude. So they're a low altitude migrant relative to a lot of songbirds.
Okay.
The average height is south of a couple hundred meters, so probably, you know, closer to like 200 to 300 feet off the ground is about what the average flight altitude is. But occasionally we get birds that are giving us data thousands of feet into the air, quite a bit higher than that. So there's variability. You know, they are compared to a lot of the like songbirds that people have estimated flight altitude for, you know, woodcock are larger bodied. And they're going shorter distances, so they probably don't have to worry about being quite as aerodynamic and quite as flight efficient. And they also have the capacity to kind of just like drop out pretty much wherever they want, as long as they're not over water. you know, and stop if they need to. So we think they fly, we don't think, they fly lower than a lot of other migrant birds. But you see some, you know, some statements out there about them flying at like 50 feet above the ground or something like that. They're migrating higher than that.
Higher than that.
Yeah.
And is that, is there any, do the ones that go much higher than that, do they really seem at this point seem to be anomalies, or is there any reason why you would think they might do that?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer for that. They're anomalies in that they're outliers in our data.
Right.
We haven't dug into it deeply enough to know if there's a rhyme or a reason.
Sure.
For why occasionally they're way higher than other times. They fly higher in the spring. There's an interesting, you know, talking about like the wind assistance earlier, the prevailing winds, I just recently learned this because I was reading a paper on it. The prevailing winds in eastern North America are actually south to north. And so when we see in the fall, they have a really strong, they're really strongly tied to that tail. And part of the reason that they're so closely tied to it is because it's less common to get a tailwind that will push them south.
Sure.
So be much more selective. And then in the spring, they're less selective because in part, it's more common to have a tailwind to go north. But then it also factors into they fly at a higher altitude in the spring and lower altitude in the fall. And it makes me think, and I'm just thinking this out loud between you and I right now, that in the fall, because they are being much choosier for the nights where there's a better tailwind, that they don't have to go as high to catch those favorable winds. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the spring, if they're departing more regularly on a lower wind speed, they might have to go a little bit higher to catch the really good northward tailwind.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. How long have you been... Was that within the last couple of years that you started getting the altitude stuff?
It's been about 3 years.
Okay.
I have there's a PhD student, Liam Berrigan, who's working on the project. He's got a defense coming up in the next month or so, and it's just putting the finishing touches on the paper that's going to describe all those altitude readings. So we've got some like hot off the press data there, but I haven't yet like fully committed it to memory, I guess.
Yeah. Cool. What else? I know when we interviewed you the first time, and kind of one of the really neat things right from the jump of this research was the stopover habitat, you know, all of the in-between before where we were banding birds and having a start point and an end point, potentially the stopover stuff. Anything new or insights regarding stopover habitat, what they're looking for, like to use, what are we missing in between, you know, from a conservation standpoint?
Well, one of the interesting things, and this isn't necessarily new, because we've kind of like known for quite a while that they're a lot more flexible in the kind of habitat they'll use during stopover. So, you know, when you're, you know, we all have this picture of what woodcock breeding habitat looks like, thick stem density, right? Whether it's an aspen clear cut or an alder stand or whatever. But then, you know, you find migrant birds hanging out in mature forests, you know, sometimes in great numbers, right? And so Liam, again, who's working on finishing up right now, he's done the first pass at looking at habitat relationships through the whole data set and trying to ask, as we go throughout different stages of the annual cycle, whether it's breeding or fall migration or wintering or spring migration, you know, like how do the habitat relationships fundamentally change? It's largely supporting that idea that during migration, they are less choosy in general, and they're by far the most choosy when they're on the breeding grounds.
Sure.
So, you know, I don't know where that leaves us, and I haven't thought hard enough about it from a habitat management perspective, because I'd be hesitant to say that just means we can ignore stopover habitat quality.
Right.
Just because they're going to go to what's available to them, and they're going to make the best decision. And if you think about what a woodcock does when it's migrating, I kind of, after watching a lot of them migrate over the last 5 years, I'm pretty well convinced the bird doesn't take off knowing exactly where it's going to end up.
Yeah.
I think it has a direction, and, you know, it knows well, I mean, knows it has a certain amount of energy in the fat stores that's built up, so it can fly a certain distance.
Might have a tailwind.
It might not have, you know, so there's a lot of variables where that woodcock, I don't think, is taken off and saying, you know, all right, you know, next stop, Central Pennsylvania. I think it's going where the wind pushes it and as far as it can go, and then it comes down, and then it just sort of makes, you know, a decision based on what's in front of it when it drops out. That's my sort of gut feeling on it. And I think that's what translates into like less selectivity for habitat during stopover, because there is just such this big element of chance involved for the bird.
Going back to that site fidelity thing, because I think that's a real interesting one, that year over year site fidelity, kind of continuing on this thread. Does that, from what we can see to this point, does that seem to be, you know, if we think of the salmon example, right, leaves the stream and goes out in the ocean, and years later it comes back to the exact same spot. Are woodcock at all like that, or is their site fidelity more random or non-existent?
They seem to be more like that. They seem to be more like the salmon than not. We don't have a ton of data on that. It's something we're working on building more into the data set now. But from the evidence we're seeing, most birds are coming pretty close. They're to just like chase your salmon analogy here. Yep. I would say they're like a salmon, but they don't necessarily care exactly which tributary they go up. So they're going to follow the main stem of the river. They're going to get pretty close. The few birds we have, for example, you know, they might have a, you know, where we caught them in the fall this year might be 3, 4, 5 miles away from where they spend the next summer. So they're in the same ballpark. Not necessarily always like going right back to the particular cover that we saw in the year before.
Yeah. That makes sense, considering, you know, they're not limited to a stream that they're swimming in. They can kind of fly and go anywhere, and the wind might push them off. But that is intriguing.
And it seems like the same thing is true on the wintering grounds, too. They're fairly site faithful to wintering areas, but again, not, you know, not exactly the same square 40-acre piece of ground.
Awesome, man. Well, I do I want to be respectful of your time, and I know we got to get you out the door here pretty quickly. This was awesome. Where would you send listeners for the most up-to-date look at what you and the team are up to?
Yeah, so we've got a project website. It's woodcockmigration.org. On that webpage, we've got a lot of resources. You'll find a subdirectory for the research page. Every year we put out an annual report. It's geared towards a technical audience, but it summarizes everything we've learned about the birds up until this point. We also have a migration subpage on there where we have up-to-date information on any birds we're currently tracking. That gets updated this time of year during migration at least once a week with new data from the migrant birds. And there's also an explore page where we've got past year's migration data. If you feel like playing around in some maps, you can look at where on a year-to-year, spring or fall basis, we've had birds migrate.
Awesome. And as far as folks contributing, obviously you mentioned the connection with American Woodcock Society. They're supporters, so by membership there, they're going to support your research. But are there other ways to perhaps support you directly and the research directly?
Yeah, I mean, we do have on the website a donation page. And if you're so inclined, we have the capacity to take donations to the University of Maine Foundation. We use that for things like supporting travel to field sites to catch and mark birds. A lot of it goes towards supporting the graduate students' work when we get those external donations. So I'm frankly happy for either of those outcomes, either supporting RGSAWS because they are a really important partner of ours, but we have an option for giving money directly to the research too, if you'd like.
Awesome. And all right, last thing, I'll have you leave listeners with this. Since it is that time of year, if somebody has never or and wants to go out and see the woodcock sky dance, What would be your recommendation? How do we go see the woodcocks, guide ants in our backyards?
Yeah, great question. It's something everybody should do if they haven't. So if you're looking for woodcock cover, which if most people are already woodcock hunters, you know what you're looking for there, but young brushy areas, preferably with an open field or a clearing or something along that realm, you know, probably in the quarter of an acre or so in size, maybe a little bit bigger. They display consistently 16 to 22 minutes after sunset. If it's a cloudy night, they'll start earlier, so more like 16 minutes after sunset. If it's a clear night, closer to 22 minutes after sunset. You're listening for the real nasally peeping sound that the males make, and then you want to pay attention. They'll usually come out, they'll peep for a little bit, and then they do this really elaborate courtship flight, hundreds of feet up into the air in this spiraling pattern, and then they drop back down to the ground. And if you do it right, you can actually approach the birds pretty closely, because when they're up and they're making that sky dance, the circling flight, they're not necessarily paying attention to what's going on the ground. So the strategy I usually use, listen to them peep for a while, wait until I hear them fly up in the air, close the distance, and if you're really good, it's fun to do something like lay on the ground right next to where the male is coming down to display. And the thing we do with the college students is we tell them to see if they can get the bird to land on them. Getting really up close and personal with them is a lot of fun.
Well, there's the challenge for the listeners, and I am certain that we all learned something today. We didn't even get a chance to talk bird dogs and hunting, but that's okay, because that means you and the team are busy with research, and we had plenty of other stuff to talk about, Eric.
And I've got a new one since the last time I talked to you. So,
what's a new one?
Oh, I got a Llewellyn setter from Kyle Warren at Pink River.
You did?
Yep.
Awesome.
And so she's 2.5 now, and keeps me real busy, but she's been great.
Excellent. All right, buddy. Well, it was a blast to catch up with you. Thanks again for all the work you guys are doing, and I appreciate you coming on the podcast and sharing it with us. Keep up the great work, my friend.
All right. Thanks a lot, Nick.
All right, buddy. Hang on with me for just a second. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.